I'm Esti Chandler from Middle East in Focus. Author Phyllis Bennis will be discussing Understanding Palestine and Israel at Midnight Books on Friday, March 27th, and at Watermelon Books on Sunday, March 29th. Co-sponsored by Jewish Voice for Peace Los Angeles, the Institute for Policy Studies, and KPFK. Further information available at kpfk.org.
Hi, this is Jamie Cromwell. You are listening to 90.7 FM KPFK Los Angeles and 98.7 FM Santa Barbara.
Welcome to Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program syndicated to radio stations, free speech, TV, and podcast platforms. On this show, you'll hear solutions journalism for social justice, fueling action, not despair. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer. This week, while I continue to be out on medical leave, I'm pleased to bring you two brand new recorded interviews. First, you'll hear an in-depth conversation with Ibram X. Kendi, one of the world's foremost historians of racism and a leading anti-racist scholar. He's also professor of history at Howard University, and he'll discuss his new book, just out now, called Chain of Ideas, The Origins of Our Authoritarian Age. The book explores the proliferation of the so-called Great Replacement Theory that's at the heart of Donald Trump's agenda. Then we'll meet a member of an anonymous guerrilla artist collective that's been plastering the walls of Los Angeles's buildings with digital animated graphics focused on political statements against billionaires, politicians, and immigration enforcement agents. Kenny, whose real identity will remain hidden, will join us to explain how and why he and his fellow artists create the subversive art and how anyone can join them and use the same digital graffiti on buildings around the nation. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech, TV, and podcast platforms. Our interviews are available to subscribers at risingupwithsonali.com. The authoritarianism on full display in Donald Trump's second term as president has a very long and sordid history in the United States. In a timely and powerful new book, acclaimed historian Ibram X. Kendi traces the history of what has been called the Great Replacement Theory to help us understand the domestic turmoil we find ourselves in today. Ibram X. Kendi is one of the world's foremost historians of racism and a leading anti-racist scholar. He's a professor of history at Howard University and the founding director of the Howard Institute for Advanced Study and the author of the National Book Award-winning Stamped from the Beginning, as well as the international bestseller How to Be an Anti-Racist, among other titles. He now joins me to discuss his new book, Chain of Ideas, The Origins of Our Authoritarian Age. Welcome to the program, Dr. Kendi.
Thank you for having me.
So we have heard this idea, the Great Replacement Theory. I've sort of heard it when I've studied Tucker Carlson's coverage on Fox News, for example. And I mentioned the Trump administration's second term, but really even the first term when we saw white supremacists marching on streets of American cities. What is the Great Replacement Theory. For those people who've never heard of it and want to understand what this means in order to meet this moment we are today, how do you define it?
Sure. Well, first, let me say I'm excited to be on your show. And so Great Replacement Theory is this notion that there is this conspiracy, particularly among liberal or even progressive elites who are apparently facilitating people of color to come and take away the lives, livelihoods, even jobs, or even electoral power of white people. And it's actually mutated from there in different countries. And so when we think about it, even in a more expansive sense, it's this notion that there's this conspiracy to take the lives, livelihoods, or even power of majority groups through disadvantaged or even minority groups. So essentially this idea that minoritized groups or disadvantaged groups are coming to take over. And the reason why this connects to authoritarianism is because you have these authoritarian politicians who are pushing this idea on majority groups, on privileged groups, saying to them that your lives are under attack, your nations are being invaded, and I'm here to protect you. And then they go about seeking to protect people by doing away with their freedoms and rights and doing away with democracy. And ultimately, they push Great Replacement Theory to get people to consent to their own domination.
So some of the contemporary purveyors of this theory, you point out in your book, you open it with Renaud Camus, who's a French author who kind of brought or articulated this in a book that became very popular in Europe. Most recently, we saw just this January, Peter Schweizer's book, The Invisible Coup, How American Elites and Foreign Powers Use Immigration as a Weapon. Tell me a little bit about these modern interpretations of and conveyances of the Great Replacement Theory before we get to the history part of it, which is the majority of your book. Do these men, and they're both men, white men, do they articulate a version of this theory that you think is playing out on the streets of the country today?
They do. And indeed, Renaud Camus, he is known as really coining the term Great Replacement Theory, or Great Replacement, I should say, in 2010 through a speech which ultimately became a book. That he wrote called The Great Replacement. But this theory, this idea had been circulating around the world, particularly the Western world, for years. But it was really Camus who named it. And just to give you a sense of how mainstream this idea is today, in Camus' work, he has argued that there's only one solution to the Great Replacement. And that is remigration, or the mass deportation of immigrants and sometimes even citizens of color, because that's the only way to get rid of those so-called invaders who are destroying the nation. And so in the United States, in many countries across Europe, that's one of the major policy platforms, policy positions of incredibly powerful political parties.
And then I mentioned Peter Schweizer, a bestseller, or a book at least that reached number one on Amazon, The Invisible Coup. In order to have these theories actually play out and governments actually enact them, don't they need foot soldiers among the citizenry? And if so, who are these foot soldiers here in the United States? What do they want?
Well, I think it's first and foremost important for us to recognize that there's been a growing amount of economic inequality in the United States over the last 3 to 4 decades. And so there are many Americans who are struggling to make ends meet, or who feel that they should be doing much better than they really are. And so what Great Replacement Theory does is it explains the reasons why certain people are struggling, particularly why white people are struggling, or men, or heterosexuals, or Christians. And it says to them that you're not getting that job because an immigrant stole it from you. You're not getting that promotion because of DEI. You're not getting your politicians elected because people of color are stealing elections. All the while, it's actually the very elected officials and their financiers who are truly behind those jobs being taken away. So it becomes this huge distraction in which people, everyday people, are actually empowering elected officials and even members of the super wealthy elite to hyper exploit them, to control them. All the while, they're thinking that those politicians are there to protect them.
So in this framework, the government is capable of protecting whites from the invading hordes who look like you and I, who look like you and me, and therefore someone like Trump then becomes their savior?
Exactly. And that's, if you study Trump's rhetoric, for years, he has presented himself, whether openly or through coded language, as the savior of white Americans, particularly white male Americans. And he has argued consistently that, directly or indirectly, that white people, white Americans, are the primary victims of racism. Indeed, going all the way back to his first run for president back in 2015 and 2016, a whole host of scholars and political scientists documented that the people, even the Republicans who were most likely to vote for him in the primaries, were those who felt that their groups, whether it was their white people or men or Christians, were under attack. Because he was presenting himself, you know, again, as their savior. So, of course, I document that in Chain of Ideas.
When we look at the way in which this Great Replacement Theory is playing out on our streets today, a lot of people think of Nazi Germany. They think of rhetoric from Adolf Hitler and seeing Jews as the invading hordes. And of course, today the analog is immigrants or people of color in general. Is that the sort of one of the points, one of the major historical markers of or precursors of the Great Replacement Theory?
So it certainly is. And that's why in Chain of Ideas, I document how Great Replacement Theory is indeed a neo-Nazi idea. And Nazi Germans like Hitler position Jews as fundamentally aliens, no matter how long they and their ancestors had been in the country or even in the continent. They imagined that these aliens were existing to poison the blood of the nation. Of course, Donald Trump recently described immigrants, particularly from Africa and Asia, as poisoning the blood of the nation. It was imagined that the only way to purify the nation, the only way to save the nation, the only way to make the nation great, was to remove these aliens from the nation, or even ultimately engage in genocide of these aliens. And of course, that's the way in which immigrants are perceived today. That's the way that Muslims are perceived today. That's the way even African Americans are perceived today. When the shooter who entered into a supermarket in Buffalo, New York, and opened fire and killed almost a dozen Black people, he positioned those Black people as the most visible group of replacers in the United States today. And so this is all certainly a marker of Nazi ideas, but I also think it's important for us to recognize the history of Nazi ideas. And so when we even think of Nazism and those ideas, some of those ideas originated in the United States. In other words, Nazis were heavily inspired by American eugenicists. One person that comes to mind is Madison Grant, who wrote a book called The Passing of the Great Race. He was a New York eugenicist, and Hitler ultimately called The Passing of the Great Race my Bible.
Now, so much of this history that you write about is actually international history, and I really appreciate the way in which you tied so many global threads together from figures all over the world, historically and contemporary, Viktor Orban in Hungary, Marine Le Pen in France, all the way to Augusto Pinochet in Chile. Let's stick with some of those older figures like Pinochet in Chile. Chile is not a country that I would expect to be part of a history of the Great Replacement theory or being, you know, a place where any of these ideas could be incubated. So how does that link up? Where does Chile fit into this?
Well, it's interesting because we were just talking about Nazism, and one of the interventions that I seek to make, and really one of the historical through lines I keep to show in Chain of Ideas, is that many of the Ku Klux Klan's men, many of the Nazis, many of the apartheid officials, many of the people who opposed decolonization are now had children or had grandchildren. And some of those children or grandchildren are now expressing Great Replacement theory, are now running for office. And instead of positioning Jews as aliens, they're positioning Black and brown immigrants or Muslims as aliens. And one of those figures is José Antonio Kast, who is the leader of the Republican Party in Chile, whose father was a Nazi lieutenant and a card-carrying member of the Nazi Party. And just to give you some context, only about 10% of Germans were card-carrying members of the Nazi Party, and José Antonio Kast's father was one of them. José Antonio Kast is about to become the next president of Chile. And in his campaign, and he's been running for president for quite some time now, he continuously, you know, positioned indigenous people in Chile, or even immigrants from places like Venezuela and Haiti, as replacers, as the harmers, you know, of Chileans. And he, of course, positioned himself as a protector, particularly of white Chileans.
So remarkable to think about that. And then, of course, you today have these forces in Europe as well. I mentioned Orban in Hungary, Marine Le Pen in France. Are all of these right-wing extremist figures who are echoing Nazi ideology in modern form, are they connected to one another? Do they coordinate with one another? I know, for example, Steve Bannon, top Trump advisor, at least in the first administration, and now sort of an outside advisor, was someone who very much participated in the coordination with right-wing leaders in Europe. Do you see them as really working together?
Well, again, I think in Chain of Ideas, that's something that I document. I document how many of these leaders, as an example, are coming to the United States to speak at CPAC, or you've had the emergence of these CPACs in countries like Hungary and Australia and Brazil and Mexico, where many of these Great Replacement politicians are gathering together to speak.
They're the Conservative Political Action Committee, CPAC.
Exactly. Right. And there's also a conference called NatCon that also has been organized in the United States and the UK, where again, many of these elected officials who express Great Replacement theory have spoken together. And then, you know, there are events in countries like Spain where you could have Donald Trump sending in a video and Viktor Orban sending in a video and Prime Minister Meloni, another Great Replacement politician of Italy, sending in a video. So there's they're constantly speaking at similar events. They're also organizing continentally, in the case of Europe, through the European Union. And so what I've found through my research is that these theorists are in constant conversation. They're learning from each other. I think for an American to read Chain of Ideas, what you'll find is many of the terms and even the strategies that Trump has used, he actually learned and gleaned from leaders in other countries that had used and perfected, frankly, those authoritarian playbooks for years.
And actually staying on Trump for just a moment, is he slightly different from his analogs elsewhere? Because Trump seems to be motivated by personal narcissism and egotism, whereas some of these other ideologues seem to actually believe some of the BS that they're putting forward. Or perhaps I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt. I don't know.
One thing I'll say is I'm probably not going to try to psychoanalyze Trump. But what I will say is that what makes Trump distinct, what makes Trump distinct, I think, from many of these other great replacement politicians is many of them are heavily funded by billionaires. Trump is both a politician and a billionaire. And so you sort of see this sort of coming together of extreme economic and political power in the placement of a Trump, while in other countries, these elected officials are really trying to advance the interests, you know, of the super elite by distracting people into believing that the source of their pain are those Black people or those immigrants or those Muslims, you know, as opposed to the people who are actually who are actually expressing great replacement theory.
What about here in the United States, where we have folks like Peter Schweitzer and then also Tucker Carlson? I mean, Tucker Carlson has been on Fox News for quite a long time. Who are some of the propagandists, the ones who not only talk about the great replacement theory, but have extrapolated it to so-called white genocide, this idea that white people are literally being erased out of existence? Who are some of those folks who are kind of positioned in prominent places of power in the United States outside of government, outside of folks like Trump?
So indeed, you mentioned Tucker Carlson, and he, according to my research, was the most pivotal great replacement theorist in the United States. As an example, the New York Times did a study of Tucker Carlson's shows and found that he had expressed derivations of great replacement theory hundreds of times, on his show. And one of the more pertinent examples was in the aftermath of the Buffalo shooting, whereby the actual shooter justified his massacre of Black people in Buffalo through great replacement theory. At first, Tucker Carlson denied that he knew great replacement theory, even as he had expressed it hundreds of times on his show. And then months later, he was back to expressing great replacement theory, particularly that this notion that the Democratic Party was importing voters, particularly voters of color, to steal elections from the Republican Party. So certainly Tucker Carlson has been one. Another major exponent of great replacement theory in the United States has been Elon Musk, he doesn't really go a week without expressing some version of great replacement theory on his X account. And his X account, his platform, of course, has become this sort of beehive of spreading and buzzing great replacement theory around the world. The aspect of great replacement theory that Elon Musk really focuses on is this notion that there's this conspiracy to reduce or keep down the birth rates of white people. And so when we think of great replacement theory, there's either this notion that people of color are coming to literally kill white people, or this notion that white people are not having enough babies. And typically those who make that case are anti-abortion, are anti-interracial marriage, are anti-queer people. They imagine that any white woman who is not having three or four babies are engaging in genocide against the white race.
And that actually is the perfect segue to the question that I was preparing to ask you, which is how the white supremacy of the Great Replacement Theory intersects with other communities and attacks on other communities. So it is a patriarchal movement. It is an anti-queer movement. Now, where do white women fit into all of this? Because plenty of white women voted for Trump. There are plenty of white women who continue to sort of support these ideas, although maybe that number is dropping. How do the male purveyors of the Great Replacement Theory think of and treat white women?
Well, they look upon white women almost totally as those who give birth to children and raise children. And their primary job, according to these great replacement theorists, is to enhance and grow the number of white people who they imagine are facing this genocide. And so any white woman who decides that they're not going to have a lot of children or who are not going to have any children at all, they're going to be demeaned in the way Vice President Vance once called white women as childless cat ladies. And so there's all this derision for white women who want to control their own bodies. There's also this notion that there is this war against men. And so there's not just this notion that white people are being subjected to replacement, but there's also this idea that men are being subjected to this replacement, and that women, particularly white women, are engaged in that, and that white women are stealing the jobs of white men, that white women are trying to steal the power of white men, so I think that is likely, I've tried to really show that mutation, that even though Great Replacement Theory was originally a racist or even an anti-Semitic idea, it has mutated into a sexist idea, into a transphobic idea, into a homophobic idea, into an ethnocentric idea. Really, wherever there are groups of people who are in positions of privilege or in the majority, they're being told that they are being replaced.
Where do people of color who might identify with right-wing forces fit into this? Now, they're obviously not majorities. There's small minorities of them. But are there folks who enable the purveyors of the Great Replacement Theory to claim they're not racist? Because there's a few non-whites in their ranks.
So there is, and in Chain of Ideas, I talk about what I call in the book proximity denial, and this is an idea that suggests that the more proximate one is, let's say, to a particular racial group, the less likely one is to be racist, which then allows, let's say, a black person who obviously is black to be able to project that they are essentially not racist. But it also, this proximity denial also allows people to imagine that the more proximate you are to the subjected group, the more of an expert you are. So it allows this, so proximity denial allows, let's say, a black person to say, I'm essentially not racist and I'm an expert on racism. The reason why this is critical for the spread of great replacement theory is, how do you spread a deeply racist theory among a population of people in the United States or in other countries who want to believe that they are not racist? Well, one of the ways in which you do that is you have these black spokespersons or brown spokespersons or Asian spokespersons who not only are pushing great replacement theory, but are also saying that the theory is not racist, the party is not racist, and the nation is not racist. And they would know because they're black. And so that is certainly happening in the United States. And frankly, in almost every country in the world, there is a few critical spokespersons of color who their only job is to argue that the party or the nation is not racist.
Who are the people who are successfully pushing back against this? This may be a little bit outside of what you've written, because your book is really exploring how this idea has spread throughout the world and what its origins are. But in order to counter the so-called great replacement theory, of course, you know, one can simply cite facts because there's plenty of facts to show that there's no such thing as white genocide. But are there folks who are successfully articulating and pushing back on this notion of white people being replaced? I'm thinking, for example, of, you know, New York City Mayor Zoran Mamdani, who has so successfully built like multiracial coalitions, including among white people, among Jewish people, without really having to, you know, be sort of angry about it, or without having to push back very overtly against these theories.
So certainly the New York City mayor is one. And what I would actually also add is Mayor Mamdani's politics is actually quite similar to the politics of other elected officials around the world who have actually pushed back successfully against great replacement politicians. And the reason why what's critically important about this politics is a politics that doesn't shy away from the existence of racism. So there's an open recognition of racism, and there's an open recognition of Islamophobia. There's an open recognition of anti-Semitism. There's an open recognition of xenophobia. And then there's an open recognition about how those forms of bigotries connect to, let's say, sexism, or connect to ageism, connect to forms of bigotry that are impacting, let's say, majority groups, so that people can see how they are truly in this together politically, so they can see who is ultimately seeking to divide and conquer them, so that while the great replacement politician projects himself, because he's usually a him, as this savior, the, you know, a New York City mayor, or even the president of Chile, who did defeat Cast, or even a leader in France who was able to hold off the rise of Marine Le Pen, they're presenting themselves as unifiers. So I'm seeking to build solidarity amongst all these different groups.
When we look at the history of the United States itself, where do the origin, you know, how do you link the current great replacement theory to the origins of this country? And obviously, you've written many books about it and have studied this greatly. But I'm wondering if you can link up with the U.S.'s own history, you know, outside of the international links. What's the analog going back to the 1700s, 1800s, and early 1900s in the United States?
Well, one of the things I try to do in Chain of Ideas is the book is organized into 10 sections, and each section is set in a different country, and each of those sections explores a particular idea or link in what I'm calling the chain of ideas. And we can understand the chain of ideas as both the foundation of great replacement theory. In other words, every idea emerges out of other ideas. But it's also the chain of ideas is frankly the ideological building blocks or the components, I should say, of great replacement theory. The reason why I mention this is because when you break down great replacement theory in its component parts, when you break down the foundation of great replacement theory in its component parts, and then you trace the history of those particular ideas, almost every one of those ideas have a long-standing history in the United States. So to give the example of the first idea, which is the zero-sum story, that apparently as Black people gain, white people lose. That's an old idea. Even Thomas Jefferson articulated that idea, as I write in Chain of Ideas, in notes on the state of Virginia, that somehow if Black people gained their freedom, white people would lose out. Even President Andrew Johnson opposed the first Civil Rights Act in 1866 based on the zero-sum notion that Black people gaining access to citizenship would somehow harm white people. Even during the Reconstruction era, when former Confederates were trying to destroy these multiracial governments that were actually providing more resources for the majority of white Southerners than even enslaver governments that were led by white people did, the way they went about breaking up those multiracial governments ideologically, in addition to violence, was to say that the more Black people gain power, the more they're going to use that power to harm white people. Even if in a very material sense, the more Black people were in positions of power in those Southern states, the more it benefited the majority of white people. They rejected that truth and tried to convince the vast majority of Southerners that those Black politicians were harming them. So there's all these, that's just one example of the history of one idea. And each of the other nine ideas have all these all this history within U.S. politics.
Well, there's so much that I could discuss with you, but I'll certainly let folks pick up a copy of Chain of Ideas themselves. And I should note that this book is researched in such great detail that the notes for this book, the citations of your research, were occupied more pages than the book itself. And so you've published those notes online for people who buy a copy of the book. They can get those notes and follow your threads of research themselves. Thank you so much, Dr. Candy, for spending this time with us, and good luck to you with the book.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Ibram X. Kendi, a professor of history at Howard University and founding director of the Howard Institute for Advanced Study, and we have been talking about his new book, Chain of Ideas, The Origins of Our Authoritarian Age. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech, TV, and podcast platforms. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. Our interviews are available to subscribers at risingupwithsonali.com. An anonymous artists collective in Los Angeles has recently been plastering buildings across the city with powerful graphics that send a strong political message. Except that the images leave no trace behind, for they are graphic projections of imagery and video. Vijay Bombs, as the collective is named, mocks billionaires, politicians, police, and especially ICE agents. Joining me now is Kenny, one of Vijay Bombs' members. To protect his identity, we're obscuring his video feed for our TV audience. Welcome to the program, Kenny.
Hi, how you doing?
Doing well. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for being on. It is really interesting to see some of these visuals on buildings. I confess I haven't seen them in person, but I've been seeing them online on your Instagram feed. And if folks have been showing up to protests in LA, especially in the evenings, they might have seen some of your art. Tell me, describe for me, for people who are unfamiliar, people who are outside LA, what your art looks like.
Yeah, so we go out with a large venue projector and we do a little pop-up art show. Most of our work is kind of in the style of like a stencil. It's very basic animation. Sometimes there's words depending on what we're trying to say. And we try to project it as big as possible in a lot of different places, sometimes in places with a lot of foot traffic, and then sometimes just for ourselves.
So I showed our TV audience one particular art installation, I think we can call it. And just to be clear, it's sometimes it's stills that kind of flip through, but often it's just animated video. And what I was just showing our TV audience was a really interesting piece that shows a man sitting at a couch watching a television. And he goes through what seems like it's a meat grinder and ends up in what looks like an ICE agent's uniform. Describe that piece for us.
So that was, we came out with that one right after the Renee Good killing. And, you know, it's kind of describing the lack of process in hiring these people. You know, a lot of these people didn't go through proper training, and that's sometimes why you find that, you know, they're so quick on the trigger with when responding and not knowing how to act in some of these high stakes situations. So it's kind of goes and it follows a guy standing up from his couch and then becoming an ICE agent and firing away.
Do you create art to respond to what's in the news? I notice there's also art around the Epstein files, which of course has been in the news quite a bit.
Yeah, so we try to kind of respond to current events as quickly as possible. Usually something will happen. There's a collective of a group of us that we have a group chain that we talk on, and we kind of throw around ideas and we'll create something hopefully the night of, and go out and respond to it with a projection, whether it be an art, words or a piece. And we kind of talk it through, the most simple way to say something that ideally doesn't involve words, but if it needs words, it needs words. And then we, from there, we'll animate it. It takes between 2 to 5 hours, I guess, to animate, depending on the complexity of it. And then that night we'll go out and do it.
How do you choose the places that you project the art, the canvas, if you will?
Yeah, it kind of varies. I mean, we have a group chain of just walls of Los Angeles. Some, you know, I think the perfect intersection, and when we hit a sweet spot, is when the architecture and the actual message become all come together to become one thing. You know, sometimes that's not possible because you're limited by the canvas that you're given of, you know, we did one at the detention center, which was great because it was about ICE and the detention center, but that's not always possible. So sometimes it will just be depending on like where we can get a lot of eyes on the projection, or sometimes like we are looking for a specific shape or you know, size or dimensions. So it kind of varies depending on what we're trying to do.
It seems as though the main point of your art, or the main approach of your art, is to mock those in power. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, I think, I don't know about mock. Well, sometimes, I think sometimes it's important to, the best way to deliver a message to maybe an audience that wouldn't necessarily be open to receiving it is through a joke. So we do lean into the humor a good amount of times. And we do, I feel like we try to focus on the people in power, knowing that they're kind of the, instead of, you know, there's a thing that we balance between like who we target. And I think we've grown to realize that the people that are in power are the ones that we want to go after, and not necessarily the people who follow them, because in a lot of times those people are the biggest victims of the situation.
That's an interesting point. So do you feel that your art has an impact, or what is the impact that you're going for with your art? And I want to, you know, put a caveat on that question, because of course artists, it isn't their job to change society. Often it's to challenge society or to reflect society. And if change does come about, that's wonderful. But I do believe in art for art's sake. But do you think that your art has an impact, or do you want it to have an impact? And if so, you know, any ideas? Do you have any idea if it's had an impact?
You know, I would hope it has some impact. I don't think, you know, we know we can't single-handedly change the world. I think the best thing we could do is spark conversation, and I think that's what we're trying to do more than anything, is keep the conversation about specific topics going. And then hopefully, you know, if there are things that people, you know, it makes people think about things in a different perspective maybe than what they're usually the way that they're usually approaching it. Like, I kind of going back to what I was saying about some people aren't necessarily open to receiving certain information in certain ways. And I think art has a very unique way of making you think about certain problems and issues, because it's not force fed through, you know, clickbait lines or anything like that. You know, a lot of it makes you kind of analyze what something is trying to say and come up with your own conclusion. And like, it's one of the more fascinating things about when we do this is watching people, you know, take it in and then kind of, I mean, some of it is very blunt and straightforward, and some of it's a little bit takes a little bit more thought when you're looking at it. So watching and talking to people about it is I think it does that, but I don't know how much change we're making by ourselves. I think the best, I think also inspiring other people to, you know, use their voice and go out and do something is also how I hope we're kind of changing or helping people, helping inspire people, because that's so important right now, is we all using our skill sets or using any power that we have to, you know, push back against what's happening.
Have you seen people respond to your art? And I should just sort of, again, for folks who aren't watching it on television, to visualize it, you're projecting these videos and imagery onto buildings in Los Angeles. So presumably you and your fellow collective members are out there sitting in a car or someplace where you have your equipment and you're projecting it. And I imagine that you see people responding. How have you noticed people reacting to your art when they see it up on the buildings? Do they pull out their phones and videotape? Do they seem excited?
I think a lot of people are excited. A lot of videotapes. It's kind of cool, I think, because there's seeing it online versus seeing it in person. I think when you see it in person, it's a little bit of like, I feel like you're seeing something that you shouldn't be, in a way, because you know it's unsanctioned. You know it shouldn't be. It's not permitted, probably, based on the content. So it is a little bit. I think people, when they see it, they're like, whoa, it is a cool experience. And I think a lot of people want to do it themselves. We've had a lot of people reach out to us of asking us how they can learn how to do what we're doing, and we, have a Discord with a bunch of, I think we're up to 1,500 projectionists on there right now, where we upload all our projections for free for people to download themselves. And then there's a how-to video on there of how to do it themselves. And we get videos of people going out and projecting in their own cities all the time, which is really cool.
Okay, that's a really great point. Let's talk a little bit more about that. So, you're not proprietary about your art. The point is the message. You're sharing it with other people to project onto buildings in their own cities. Do you know? So that's been happening now around the country?
Yeah, it's cool. I mean, it's slowly but surely more and more people are doing it. Last year for the No Kings protest, we did a nationwide projection protest where it was the first time where we kind of started organizing our Discord and teaching people how to do it. And that was in October. And at that point, we had 30 states and four countries do it at the same time, which was cool. But now it's becoming a more regular thing. It's not as organized. But I think we will do another nationwide protest like that sometime this year, coming up into the midterms. But people are going out. We had, a couple people in Minnesota do it after all this stuff going on over there. There's, people all throughout California. We get, people in the middle of nowhere projecting on the side of their barn. And they'll send us videos, and we're very, if you go out and you project some of our stuff and send it to us, we will happily share it with people on our account.
And actually,
So,
what is the Instagram feed where I know that you post your latest videos where people can find you online?
I'm sorry, what
What is your
was the
Instagram
question?
handle?
It's VJ Bombs is our handle, and then that's on all platforms. So
And that's
V.
VJAY Bombs, BOMBS. Kenny, you alluded a little bit earlier to the fact that, well, this sort of projection may not be permitted. I imagine that's one reason why you obscure your identities. It's kind of walking a legal gray line, but sometimes the best, the most challenging, the most provocative art is unsanctioned, right? To ask permission kind of defeats the purpose.
Yeah, I think I really we're trying to I think it's important not to dive too far into the like that aspect, because I do think the more important thing is the art. But there is it's unpermitted, it is it doesn't hurt property or anything like that. So it's very I think it's a good line of good trouble, I guess you could say. We are very adamant about always projecting from public places. When we talk to police officers, it's usually very positive. We have had very rare run-in, and it's usually not involving us, to be honest. And we just fall back on, and we're exercising our First Amendment right. And this is peaceful protest, and we'll be here for this amount of time. And it's been very positive, to be honest. We're not out there running from the cops all the time, Miles. And I think that's like an assumption that people make by when they see our stuff is it's some kind of bad boy kind of vigilantism. And kind of want to push back against that a little bit. And that's part of the reason why I don't like taking interviews with masks or anything like that, because we are positive. We are a loving organization. We are fully peaceful. I think what we're doing, we ask for forgiveness instead of permission just because it's easier that way. But I think all in all, the way we're doing it, I think we want to focus more on the art than like the actual vigilantism of it, I guess you could say.
How long has the collective been around? Can you give me a sense of how it started? What was the story of VJ Bombs?
So actually, it's been around since July 2024. We our first projection ever was we went out after the Joe Biden and Donald Trump debate, and we did a projection about Joe Biden asking him to step out of the race. That's how it started, and then it slowly, you know, we did a couple more during the RNC, which happened shortly after. And then it kind of blossomed from there. I think we started getting a little traction online. People recognize it's a cool new age way of protesting. And I think it wasn't possible doing what we're doing 5-10 years ago because of modern advancements in technology and size of projectors and batteries. So it's very like modern in that way. And I think it's a little cutting edge, and people have been doing it for a very long time, but their setups were completely different. It took a lot more work, whereas now we can kind of show up and with a smaller projector that's very powerful and hit a wall super easily. And I think people saw it online, and it kind of resonated with a lot of people, because there's something to, you know, seeing people out there with a sign instead of, you know, posting a meme or a video online. I think that resonates more with people, and it kind of snowballed from there, and we've been doing it ever since.
And are you open to new members? Are you encouraging people to start their own collectives?
Yeah, I think anybody who projects, our imagery from our Discord is, I would say, members of VJ Bombs, you know? I think there's tons of collectives and people that do this as well. We're one of many, and we're definitely novices in the space compared to a lot of people. We went to a couple VJ meetups, which is, you know, VJ stands for visual DJ, and it's like an art form that's been going around. It's been around since the beginning of, you know, modern video. Essentially, it's just live editing video. So we went to a meetup in LA like last year, and it made me realize how big this space is and how many people there are. And like, we do more of the guerrilla, a lot of those people do like live shows and events, and we do the more guerrilla aspect of it, but it's a super cool community, and there's a lot of people who are doing the guerrilla projection stuff as well, you know. The Led by Donkeys guys in the UK, check them out, they're amazing. They do more like long form documentary stuff. The Illuminator in New York, we've worked with them a couple times. Those are just some of the bigger names, but there's tons of small collectives as well.
And then how can people get a hold of you if they hear this interview and want to be able to project your art in their town?
I would say you could DM us on Instagram, or you can shoot us an email. It's just our handle at gmail.com.
And you're also selling merch on your website, I imagine, to help support, financially support merch. The work?
Yeah, exactly. We sell it to help support our project. We all have actual jobs as well. We're filmmakers by day. So this is kind of our side project that we're, you know, and it takes a lot of time, and creating the art takes a lot of time. So all that profit goes to funding this project.
And the website is vjaybombs.com, where people can also find the links to social media and merch. Well, Kenny, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. My guest has been Kenny, member of the anonymous artists collective called VJ Bombs. I'm Sonali Kohatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. We'll be right back.
This Wednesday morning, KPFK brings you live coverage of a Senate hearing on the nomination of Mark Wayne Mullen for Secretary of Homeland Security. Starting at 6:30 a.m., we'll carry the hearing as it happens, followed by post-hearing analysis hosted by KPFA's Brian Edwards-Tiegert. Join us for live, in-depth coverage of a key moment in national politics. That's this Wednesday at 6:30 a.m., right here on KPFK.
Hello, this is Martin Sheen, and you're listening to KPFK 90.